Radio MD. RadioMD.com.
He's a cardiologist. He's a chef. He's America's culinary interventionalist. It's time for Code Delicious with Dr. Michael Fenster.
Hello, Food Nation, Healthy Nation. Are you ready for the scrumptious and the salubrious all wrapped up into one tasty treat? I know that you are, and I know you know that means it's time once again for another Code Delicious. I am Dr. Mike. This is Code Delicious, brought to us by my friends at Real Salt. You know, I always talk about using real, authentic food, and when you're cooking with that, you want to build those layers of flavor with real seasonings. Real Salt is mined from an ancient evaporated ocean back in the days when the world was young and probably a lot healthier than it is today. So head on over to realsalt.com, put in Dr. Mike on the coupon code, get yourself some extra discounts over there. Today I am absolutely delighted to have somebody who I feel like I know because I've been drinking his wines for, it seems like, forever. Absolutely fantastic wines. I've got Bruce Cakebread. He's the president and chief operating officer of Cakebread Cellars. I know that you've heard about that. He's responsible for overseeing the day-to-day operations of the winery, the family vineyards, and all grower relations. He's been doing this for over 35 years, and you know, he said that our goal has been to work with our vineyards to gain the full potential of quality from each vine, allowing us to create the finest wines possible. And you know, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about food, wine, everything here on Code Delicious. It's all about quality over quantity. Bruce actually first studied pomology, the study of tree fruits, at California Polytech in San Luis Obispo. When he decided to enter the family business, he transferred to viticulture and enology program at the University of California, Davis, renowned for their wine program back in 78, got his degree in enology, and he's been working alongside his father at the family vineyard since 73, and he was the chief winemaker from 79 to 2002 when he took over as president and COO. Bruce, thanks so much for being on the program today.
Great. Thank you for having me.
So, for all the folks out there, my new book, Ancient Eats, just came out. You can pick that up on Amazon.com. And in that, I talk about ancient Greek cuisine, and of course, wine was just such a integral part of their cuisine and something we see carried down in the modern interpretation of that in the modern Mediterranean diet. We know that's filled with health benefits, also a lot of pleasure from great wine. And so I want to start at the real basics, if you could, Bruce, and just help our viewers understand, you know, exactly how do you make wine and maybe what's changed the way you do it today versus, you know, some Greek stomping in a barrel 2,000 years ago.
Well, it's kind of interesting. If you think just grape juice and you let it go, you're going to end up with vinegar. And so our job is to kind of stop it before it goes all that way. And so, again, we start out in the vineyards, kind of tending the vines to kind of get the best fruit possible. And what's interesting is, if you think about a grapevine wants to ripen its fruit and allow a bird to come by and eat the berry and take the seed down, plant it down the river, and grow another grapevine. And so that grapevine is going to create a diversity of maturity within that cluster. Some are going to be green, some are going to be overripe. And so our job, what we're trying to do is get the vine to produce nice, even maturity, even ripening, so that when we make the wines, we have kind of that really nice, just direct kind of concentration of nice, ripe flavors to the wine. And so it kind of starts out in the vineyard of how we work our vines to kind of get that even maturity just within the cluster.
And so once we've picked the grapes, then what happens? What's the next process? Because it's coming up on harvest time in Napa, isn't it?
Yeah, we're in the thick of harvest. And so we started the beginning of August with Sauvignon Blanc. Different varieties will ripen at different times. Sauvignon Blanc is always first. Then we move into Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. Right now, we're harvesting Merlot, and we should finish up Cabernet in the next 2 weeks. And so for us, it takes us 8 to 10 weeks to bring in all the fruit. But what we do is we start in the middle of the night harvesting the fruit for that day. And so the reason why we want a night pick, a lot of wineries in Napa are doing this, is we get the fruit in ice cold. And so that a good analogy is if you take an apple, cut it in half, put one out in the sun and one in the refrigerator. One in the refrigerator is going to taste best. And so that's basically, we want to get nice cool fruit in to keep the freshness to it. Also, you get less extraction or harshness from the skins. If it's Sauvignon Blanc or Chardonnay white grapes, we press it very gently to get the juice out of the grapes. If it's red grapes like Merlot or Cabernet or Pinot Noir, we'll de-stem, we'll take the berries off the stems, and we'll pump the juice, the seeds, and the skins into the tank, and it's called must at that stage. Then we'll add our yeast, and the yeast are going to use the sugar in the grape juice. If you taste a wine grape berry, it's a lot sweeter than like table grapes. And so the yeast will use the sugar in the grapes as energy to produce alcohol, carbon dioxide, and heat. And so in white wines, we don't want the heat. We have this juice, looks like unfiltered apple juice. We'll start the fermentation up in a stainless steel tank, and if it's like Chardonnay, we'll move it to French oak barrels and age the wine and allow the fermentation to take place in those barrels, which takes about 2 weeks for us. If it's red grapes, the Cabernets and the Merlots, we'll ferment on the skins, and we want that heat to get up in the fermentation so we get good extraction of tannin and color from the skins and the seeds. When all the wine's gone dry, no sugar left, we'll drain the juice off, press it out, and then move the finished wine now into barrels to start its aging process.
And so a lot of folks, think that white wine comes from white grapes and red wine comes from red grapes, and rosé is, you know, when you mix the two. But you're saying that the red wine comes, for our listeners to understand, actually comes from being left in contact with the skin. So there's a little bit different processing between the red and white. Do I have that right?
Yeah, exactly. If you take like a Cabernet Sauvignon grape, it's been right before we harvest it now. It looks purple. But if you crush it, the juice is going to come out clear. You'd look at it like Sauvignon Blanc or a white wine. You'd say, what's the difference? And that's how you're making your rosés. You, instead of fermenting on the skins, you just press it quite quickly. So all the color, all the tannins for like Cabernet is going to come from the skins and the seeds. And so this is what happens during fermentation with that heat and what we call pump overs, taking the juice from the bottom of the tank and let it run over the skins during fermentation there.
And you talk about fermentation, and that's kind of a big thing now kind of in the culinary world, but also in the health world. We've learned from our chef friends and from winemakers like yourself that these fermented foods actually have a tremendous amount of health benefits, really help the gut microbiome, restore a natural balance of healthful gut bacteria. And I guess back in the day, from my research on how the ancient Greeks made wine, a lot of times they would there's a natural wild yeast that would sort of settle on the vines. But you said you guys actually control what kind of yeast you're using. Is that right?
Well, we do it both ways. If the fruit's clean and all the conditions are kind of perfect, then we'll allow the yeast that are on the grapes to start up the fermentation and let that go take over. If we wanted, some of the different yeasts have different characteristics, and so we can use those characteristics also fermenting in the wine to have the wine come out slightly different as well. Very, very subtle. But what we're trying to do is create complexity with all the different lots. And so in anything in agriculture, diversity is always going to be a little bit better than kind of trying to do, something, kind of in a mono method there. And so that's where we'll use some native yeast, some cultured yeast to kind of give us that complexity.
That's so fascinating. So in some instances, you're actually doing it not much different than this was made, over thousands of years ago. And one of the fascinating things that I came across, and we talk about this in the book Ancient Eats, looking at the Greeks, is everybody thinks, well, they sort of had this jug wine, which they did, but you could get a huge amphora, and you referenced it at the beginning, of wine vinegar, which was a big business back then. And they had their table wines, their jug wines, the two-buck chuck equivalent, if you will.
Uh-huh.
But they also had special amphora that were labeled with the year that it was harvested, where it was harvested, and the grower. And for all the world, when I was reading it, I said, well, that sounds like the Appalachian system that we use today. And is that pretty much it? If we're calling a wine from Napa Valley, are those the things that we're paying attention to?
Yeah, you know, the process hasn't changed over, you know, as you say, to ancient times. And so what we've done is just being able to identify what soils grapevines grow better on than others. And so wine's been made in Napa Valley for 150 years. And so they've learned what sites, you know, wow, what sites have better gravel or drainage than other sites. And so that's where you'll plant your Cabernet, and soils that are a little bit more clay, that's where you're going to plant your Sauvignon Blanc. And so we have this history of observation of how the wines come out over these last 150 years that have been really helpful to kind of get Napa Valley to the top. And it's just that observation and learning from previous experiences that help you get the wines better and better.
Well, you guys also had the French surprise, you know, way back when, and I don't want to date anyone here because I remember it, but I think it was Chateau Montelena and Stag's Leap were the brands mm-hmm. involved. And you want to tell the listeners about that a little bit? Because that, I think that was, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that was something that really put you guys in Napa on the map.
Well, it was in the early days, in the 70s for us. There's a comparison. We're making these wines in Napa Valley and out in California. And, you know, in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, people knew of them. But kind of beyond that, you know, on the East Coast, they didn't know about what we were doing out here. And so the tasting that Stephen Spurrier put on, kind of blind tasting some of the best French wines, some of the best Napa Valley wines, really opened up the eyes in these markets, because, you know, you look today and information and, you know, we sell wines around the world today. It's easier to get that information out. But back in those days, you know, that information wasn't spreading as quickly. And so this is where that tasting really helped put Napa Valley on the map. What's kind of nice is that in Napa Valley, you know, we're a small region, and you kind of break it down, and we're just really a small agricultural valley. And so, you know, high tides rise all boats. And so what's good for Chateau Montelena or Stag's Leap wine cellars is also good for the whole valley. And that philosophy still permeates all the winemakers today, is that, you know, if Napa Valley's doing well, then everyone will do well.
Hey, folks, you are listening to Code Delicious with Dr. Mike here on RadioMD.com. I'm talking to my guest today, Bruce Cakebread. That's right, Cakebread of the famous vineyard. You see his name all over fine wine distributors throughout the country, throughout the world. And this is brought to you by our friends over at Real Salt. Hey, we're talking about real food, real flavors, really good wine. When you cook, folks, you want to make sure you use real seasoning. You might be surprised when you look at some salts that contain fillers, anti-caking chemicals, even dextrose, a form of sugar. Head on over to realsalt.com. Go to fine grocers around the country. Look for Real Salt. That's what I use for real taste and real flavor. And so, Bruce, I've got to ask you real simply, what makes, in your mind, a great wine? What are you striving for? And are you a red or white guy?
So what I look for in a wine, and what we try and do for our style, is show really nice balance. You know, we work really hard out in the vineyards, so we want to show off nice fruit character, have our oak kind of in the background to add complexity. And then we like wines that are nice and dry, not residual sugars, so the wines are completely dry. And we think those wines will go best with foods. In terms of how we kind of, you know, what wines are we having with what foods, we kind of like to use kind of the intensity. And so if it's a delicate wine, we're going to have delicate foods with it. So you take like Sauvignon Blanc and goat cheese would go nicely, whereas mm-hmm. maybe a Chardonnay might go better with a Brie cheese. And so you're trying to match intensities of wine with the intensities of food. And so when it's warmer, we're drinking, you know, and we're eating lighter. And so we're going to drink a little bit lighter. We'll have a nice rosé or a nice Sauvignon Blanc or a lighter style Chardonnay during the summers, or, you know, for having salmon, maybe the Pinot Noir is in there. Then as we get into the fall right now, starting to drink Merlots, you know, for lunch or, you know, sometimes dinner. because the wine's a little bit heavier and the food's starting to change. The summer garden's starting to kind of not produce as much tomatoes and that type of stuff. And so you start to evolve, and then when you get into winter, you're drinking your heavier wines because you're just eating heavier.
Well, I love that. And you bring up a great point, which is sort of the seasonality of food. And that's a big emphasis in my approach to food, and something, again, that was very natural to folks up until sort of recent times, the last sort of 50, 75 years, when there's been big changes to our pathways. But for folks, you know, you don't have to stick to one wine or the other. Let it vary as the seasons vary, as, you know, you're getting that abundance from the farmer's market. And as you said, you know, maybe fall's coming into the air, you're getting a little bit heavier, getting those fall squashes, those winter squashes, you know, some of the other, in ancient times, again, this is when they'd start to slaughter the animals. So as you said, you're kind of getting those heavier meats. What is it that you look for? So, you know, and I probably don't know anything about wine, but I want to try to appreciate, you talk about the complexities and the flavors of wine. What are the things that I look for? How do I approach a glass of wine so I can look smart and sophisticated like you?
Hey, you know, the wine tasting is pretty simple. You know, and when you smell it and you taste it, you know, the first question in my mind is, does this taste good? And it's very, very subjective, and everybody gets an A+ on it. But that's a, kind of the key thing. Doesn't matter what type of oak and all this other things that we're doing. To me, that's always very, very interesting. But when you get down to the basic thing, it's like thumbs up or thumbs down in the Roman days. It's like, yeah, I like it, or no, I don't. And then that's, you can great. Go from there and just be able to enjoy what I enjoy when you take anything. If I know more about the background, how it's made, whether it's food, you know, how that food was grown, or, you know, if this is a heritage tomato or whatever, you have deeper appreciation for that food. It's the same way with wine, just a little bit of knowledge, kind of like, oh, okay, now I understand that. You get an additional appreciation and enjoyment of the wine as well. So I enjoy that with food, knowing a little bit more about how our food was grown or where it came from, as well as kind of it's the same in wine.
Well, that's great. And that's really useful information, because sort of the undercurrent of what you highlighted there is really what I tell folks about appreciating food. You know, does it taste great? And what you'll find is that when there's quality, when there's freshness, that's where you find the flavor, you know, and that's what great young chefs have been doing for the last decade plus around the country, kind of locally sourcing those ingredients, bringing them to our tables for us. And then we in the medical community kind of followed on the heels of that and said, oh, wow, look at this. When you eat real food, people start feeling better. Our bodies respond positively because this is the stuff that both our bodies and our gut microbiome that's co-evolved with us over hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, has co-evolved to process. So it's a very much in sync, very much in harmony. But you made it simple for folks, and you took sort of a lot of the pressure off the, you know, the sniffing and the swirling. So I really appreciate that. Where can folks go to find out more about what you're doing, website or such?
So we have two websites for you. One is the winery's website, cakebread.com, pretty easy. And then the other one is napavintners.com, which will give you more background about Napa Valley. They have a great running feed about how the harvest is going. And so all the winemakers are putting their thoughts in almost on a daily basis of what they're doing at each of the wineries. And so that's also a good just general resource about what makes Napa special and for wine.
Okay, and since I got you on the radio, I'm going to put you on the spot. Any tips for us about this harvest or any cake breads we should be looking for, vintages that are coming out in the near future? A little plus to all our listeners today. A little
there
inside
you go.
Information.
For this harvest, we're always a half glass full, very, very optimistic. And so we always think, you know, the current harvest is the one we're going to do our best on. You know, we're always trying to improve. And so 2016 is going to be fantastic. What we've been blessed with, you know, we've had a drought in California for the last 4 years. And so that's the lemon. But the lemonade out of it is we've been blessed with kind of a great string of vintages, starting with 2012 13, 14, 15, and we think 16 is right there. And so that's where Mother Nature is kind of making it up. It's like you might not have that much water to drink, but you can always have a nice glass of wine.
That's great. And folks, don't forget the health benefits. You can check out my articles on psychologytoday.com, my regular column there. And I've talked about some of the healthful wine benefits, particularly with the Mediterranean approach. Again, that website is cakebread.com and napavintners.com. You want to head over there. I want to really thank Bruce. It's been such a pleasure having you on, and the time has really flown. So again, I'm going to put you on the spot, and I hope I can invite you to come back and talk more wine, food, and health with us down the road a little bit when harvest eases up a little bit.
I'll be happy to. That's kind of my favorite subject, so that's easy.
Mine too. Thanks so much, Bruce. It's been a pleasure today. You have been listening to Code Delicious with Dr. Mike, and until we meet again, may the only pain in your life be champagne.